Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we talk about curbing the cost of prescription drugs. The U.S. spends 18% of its gross domestic product on health care, and between 10 to 20% of our expenditures are on pharmaceuticals. In the past few years, drug companies have made national news for innovative medications that manage or even cure diseases, such as hepatitis C. However, the pharmaceutical industry has also garnered attention for the high cost of these new medications and dramatic increases in the price of older drugs. Companies such as Turing and Valeant Pharmaceuticals ignited public outrage in 2016 when they raised prices on life-saving medications by as much as 5,000%. Renewed interest in curbing the cost of pharmaceuticals has led to a bipartisan discussion about increasing transparency and reducing costs. This month, the National Academy of Sciences published a 200-page report outlining potential policy changes at the federal level. While in October, Governor Brown signed Senate Bill 17, legislation aimed at shining a light on prescription drug prices. However, it's not all smooth sailing from here. Just this month, drug companies sued the state of California over SB 17, claiming the law is unconstitutional. Tonight on our program, we ask, why are medications so expensive? What is California doing to increase transparency and ensure access to life-saving medications? What else can be done, whether at the federal level or elsewhere? And what can you, the consumer, do to reduce the cost of your drugs? I have three guests with me tonight. They're all joining me by phone. First is Robin Feldman, professor and director of the Institute for Innovation Law at the University of California, Hastings. She is the author of Drug Wars, How Big Pharma Raises Prices and Keeps Generics Off the Market, and Rethinking Patent Law. Welcome, Robin Feldman.
Nice to be here.
We're also joined this evening by Lisa Gill, deputy editor of Consumer Reports' Best Buy Drugs, a program focused on the safety, efficacy, and cost of medications with the goal of providing consumers and their doctors information to guide their prescription drug choices. Lisa is Consumer Reports' primary spokesperson on medication issues. Welcome, Lisa Gill.
Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to the discussion.
And finally, we're joined by Senator Ed Hernandez of the 22nd Senate District in San Gabriel County. An optometrist, he's the chair for the Senate Committee on Health and for the Senate Committee on Legislative Ethics. Senator Hernandez is also the author of Senate Bill 17. Welcome, Senator Hernandez.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. The number to dial in about 20 minutes is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Just one disclosure. As most of you know, I am a physician. I also sit on the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee for the San Francisco Health Plan, which is a Medi-Cal managed care insurance plan in the county of San Francisco. And the committee itself helps to select the formulary for the health plan. However, my comments and presence here tonight does not reflect the San Francisco Health Plan's views or opinions. So with that out of the way, let me start with you, Robin Feldman. The first question we all want to know is, why do drugs cost so much? Why do prescription drugs cost so much?
Well, the cost of medication is certainly very high. It's going faster than any other form of healthcare spending, including hospitalization or nursing care. And a significant amount of the rise is coming from price increases on existing drugs. Now, those rising prices are a boon for the pharmaceutical industry. For example, in one recent year, 80% of the growth in profits of the 20 largest drug companies came from price increases, not from new drugs, just from raising prices. And those prices are causing real pain for patients and for government budgets. There are a few key drivers, although it's a complex issue. One is what I would call extending the protection cliff. Patents are supposed to last for a limited amount of time, after which generics enter the market and drive prices down. But that's not what's happening. Rather, drug companies pile new protections onto their drugs to extend the protection cliff. I recently completed a long-range study tracking every time a company extended the protection cliff on any drug on the market, and the results were stunning. So rather than creating new medicines, drug companies are largely recycling and repurposing old ones. So, for example, across the entire time period, 3/4 of the drugs associated with new patents were not new drugs coming on the market, but existing drugs. In other words, we're lavishing rewards on existing drugs in a way that allows companies to extend their competition-free zones and raise these prices unchallenged. Now, companies manage to extend their protection in many ways. The most popular approach is to make slight modification to the drug's dosage or delivery system and get shiny new patents. These patents may be of questionable validity, but challenging them is a long and expensive road for any generic competitor. Another tempting approach for extending the protection cliff is to get an orphan drug designation. Drug doesn't have to be new or to be better than other treatments to get an orphan drug designation, but you get 7 more years of protection. It's a little like winning the lottery. Other games involve paying generic companies to stay off the market, filing frivolous petitions at the FDA to try to block competitors, refusing to provide testing samples to generics or to cooperate on safety plans. The second key driver is what I would call formulary games. With both government and private health insurance, the actual price of the drug is determined by contracts between the drug company and intermediaries. Now, these pricing contracts are incredibly complex and highly secretive. The entities paying the bills, like Kaiser or Cigna, or even the state of California, are not permitted to know the details of the price of individual drugs based on gag rules in the intermediary contracts. However, we can tease out a series of games played through these contracts in which cheaper drugs are either excluded from reimbursement or disadvantaged in some way. These secret deals are the opposite of the type of open competition that benefits societies and consumers. So in short, misuse of the patent and the regulatory systems is not limited to a few pharma bad apples like the ones you mentioned in the opening, Valiant, Turing. It's business as usual throughout the pharmaceutical industry, and that drives prices higher.
So just to get a clearer, if you can't be any clearer actually than you have been, but just to be clear about this, there's no scientific benefit to necessarily to the recycling or repurposing of old drugs. It's just a game or a gimmick to be able to extend the patent protection.
So tweaks may be enough to get you past the patent office, but they may not mean very much at all in terms of a benefit to patients. Those are two very different things. It's even more so when you're talking about certain non-patent benefits that you can get from the FDA, like the orphan drug exclusivity. The FDA recently reminded everybody in a ruling that in order to get the orphan drug exclusivity, you don't need to have a, quote, plausible theory of superiority. In other words, you don't even have to have a claim that it's any better.
So where is the FDA in all of this? How are they involved or not involved in monitoring these tweaks, as you call them, or these games?
Traditionally, the FDA has been excellent at safety and efficacy. It has not been particularly effective at policing competitive games. There are a variety of ways in which Congress has tried to prod the FDA to play that role. FDA has been reluctant to get involved in that.
And then you mentioned that most of the drugs that are, or the new drugs that are coming to market, are not actually new. They're minor changes that cross the patent extension threshold. But there are some new medications out there. What's the percentage of new medications that are truly novel and the ones that are just tweaked to get the patent extension?
So, again, in the research that I looked at for the new patents, the majority of the drugs associated with the new patents were getting tweaked. It's a It's a little bit different than the question that you asked. I don't know the actual answer to that question. There are certainly innovative drugs coming out on the market. The question is, are we making sure that the system is designed to encourage and reward that? My concern is that pharmaceutical companies are shifting away from innovative activity, choosing instead to manipulate legal and regulatory pathways that sustain existing sources of monopoly revenue. The most creative activity at a pharmaceutical company should be happening in the research and development department, not in the legal department. But our incentives are not pushing companies in the right directions.
And then,
I just want to jump in and just give a great example to what Robin is talking about. Yes, this is Lisa Gill, and Robin's work is so important here, and it's so good to start with this sort of leveling of understanding. And I was going to just jump in and give you a good example of a drug called Trexamet. This is just a perfect one. So Trexamet is a so-called brand new drug, and it's comprised of two really old medications, and it's a drug to treat migraines, and it's sumatriptan combined with naproxen. And I'm looking right now, and the cheapest I can find it is for 9 tablets, $695. Now, you might be thinking, well, if I have a migraine, I'll pay any amount of money. You know, forget, it doesn't matter. Well, I'll put it on my credit card, whatever. But here's the thing. You can get sumatriptan and naproxen separately, because they've been around for so long, for $18 for the two of them. So this is a perfect example of a crazy gouging that the FDA doesn't really have the authority to say no to, because it's technically a new drug since it's a new combination.
So then how about the new drugs? You know, there's a lot of press about the cost of the novel hepatitis C treatments over the last several years, and that, you know, $1,000 a pill for a 12-week treatment. So say more about that. Why are those drugs expensive? Surely there must be some rationale for that.
Sure. So the first hepatitis C drug had no competitor. So it came out on the market at over $84,000 or somewhere in that neighborhood. They did not have to negotiate, you know, the pharmaceutical company did not have to negotiate with insurance companies or the state of California or any other state for that matter. And they basically set the price at whatever they wanted, because that is perfectly, you know, it's legal. And so that's what they do. When a competitor came into the market, we saw that price drop by nearly into the $50,000 range, which is still expensive, but there was some market concessions that helped people out. And that's the most I can say about it, but I would imagine Senator Fernandez has a lot to say, because the state of California has paid a lot for both of those treatments.
So Senator Hernandez, what's your take on why new drugs cost so much? You know, the conventional wisdom is, you know, it takes a lot of money to do the research and develop these medications.
You know, it does take a lot of money and research to develop them, but they hit the nail on the head. Essentially, when a new drug comes out, there is essentially a monopoly, and it's supply and demand. If there is very few entities that are offering the product, and insurance companies and or state entities need to buy it. And I'll give you an example. When the Sovaldi came out, we had to do a mid-year, year-and-a-half budget augmentation for one drug that the state of California purchased. This is only for the Medi-Cal system, over $340 million. To date, the Medi-Cal system has spent in excess of $1 billion for the one particular drug. And that's why I introduced the bill, to look at some kind of transparency, but more importantly, to make sure that we can have a conversation about where this conversation is going and the direction. As Robin mentioned, I mean, you have a lot of pharmaceutical drug companies that are just tweaking current prescription medications that they extend the patents on, and they're the only ones that have those patents, and they can set the price. There's not enough competition in the market, and there's not enough transparency. And if we are mandating that every person in this country buy health insurance, I think it's incumbent upon government to ask those tough questions, and that's why I introduced the bill.
So to play devil's advocate here, we're in a free market system. Why isn't it to, you know, the prerogative of a pharmaceutical company to charge whatever the market will bear?
Well, you're not in a free market system.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Who wants to go first?
So let me go first. This is Senator Ed Hernandez.
Okay.
So I agree. We are in a free market system, and that's why when I looked at SB 17, I made very, very careful that I did not set prices. This is purely does two things. It looks at transparency, the actual year-over-year increase to the prescription drugs and the cost to the purchasers, which is the plans, the Medi-Cal, CalPERS. But more importantly, it's to require the pharmaceutical drug companies to give advance notice so that these purchasers can start to negotiate better prices when it comes to the cost of those prescription drugs. But let's give an example. You had mentioned this is a free market. Yes, it's a free market. But my earlier comment, everybody's required to buy health insurance. We're not requiring everybody to buy an automobile or to buy an iPhone or to buy a widescreen television. Plus, those particular products, there's many consumers out there, there's a lot of competition because the auto dealers, there's a number of cars that are out there. You don't have a fair marketing system and a fair system when it comes to economics for the prescription drug medications, and that's why they can set the prices they do. And like I said, when you have consumers that by law, they have to buy health insurance, there's a market that is primed for them to set the price of whatever they want.
And
this is Professor Feldman.
Yes.
I'd love to offer some thoughts here because I am a strong proponent of competition-free enterprise as well as the patent system. You are right that drug research and development is slow and expensive. So intellectual property such as patents or other regulatory benefits give companies an opportunity to recoup costs and profit from their innovations, but all good things must come to an end. The same is true for patents. In theory, a drug company will have had perhaps a decade of sales with no one else in the market and have earned a tidy sum. Now we want them to go back to the bench and develop treatments. So the problem is that the temptation to avoid the impact of falling off the patent cliff is overpowering. For a blockbuster drug, even a few more months without competition can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Can't expect rats in the maze to run in the right direction if the cheese is located at the other end. And right now, the cheese is poorly located because we have so many opportunities for pharmaceutical companies to game the system.
You know, I'd like to interject and just also talk about the patenting. Yes, I agree, and I understand that there's investments that the pharmaceutical drug companies need to make with regard to the patenting. But let me tell you, the profits are there, and they're there in excess of numbers. If you look at most of the patenting in this country, I would say at least half of the patenting is paid for by the federal government or a university system. Not that they don't invest into patenting as well, but think about for every dollar they spend in marketing and research, they spend $17 in advertising or marketing itself. So they're
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time?
For every dollar they spend in research and development, they spend approximately $17 in marketing on the television. Now, you can't go an evening without watching television and seeing new ads for any drugs. You now have ads for medications for constipation for taking opioids.
So you're basically saying that the actual lion's share of money is goes towards marketing and not necessarily research and development, as we have been led to believe.
No, I mean, they do spend quite a bit on research and development, but a lot of that research and development money comes from the federal government, obviously in the university system. But my point is that they're doing well because they can spend the kind of money that they spend in marketing. If they weren't doing well, they wouldn't be spending those kinds of dollars, and their revenues are significant. They're in the double digits, as opposed to look at health plans, look at providers, look at hospitals that are in single-digit returns.
Well, I want to reintroduce the program if you're just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing how California and other parts of our country or the federal government might curb the cost of prescription drugs with our guests Robin Feldman, Director of the Institute for Innovation Law at the University of California, Hastings, Lisa Gill, Deputy Editor of Consumer Reports, Best Buy, DUI drugs, and Senator Ed Hernandez, the chair for the Senate Committee on Health and author of Senate Bill 17. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Have you faced increases in the prices of your medications? If so, how did you manage that? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website. Tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So we're talking so far about how the incentives are in the wrong direction, right? In order for pharmaceutical companies to continue to reap profits, they need to do whatever they can that's legal to extend patents by tweaking medications. And in fact, things are lopsided towards tweaks of old medications rather than novel drugs. And then, Senator Hernandez, your point was that for every dollar spent on research and development, $17 is spent on marketing. So why don't we take it to a personal level for a moment? And I want to turn to both you, Senator Hernandez, but first, Lisa Gill. Tell us how where consumers get caught, how they get caught in these situations where their drug prices skyrocket. Doesn't insurance protect them?
Right. So you would think insurance would protect a consumer from facing a sudden spike in the price of the medication that they take. And so, you know, right now we're talking about really high-ticket medications, right? And we're talking about new drugs coming out that are also extremely highly priced. And those are important because they are drivers of how insurance coverage, it eventually trickles down to the everyday consumer. But one of the things that we've looked at very closely are what is the experience of a person when they go fill a prescription at the pharmacy counter for a drug they take day in and day out, and it's not an expensive medication. It's an antidepressant. It's an old school blood pressure medication. It's a drug to lower their cholesterol. These medications are the majority of what consumers take. It's almost nearly in the high 80s, almost 90% generics, and you can see that people still are suffering from this problem, but it's on a different level. It's almost, I don't want to minimize it by calling it nickel and dime, but what we can see from a recent nationally representative telephone survey just a few months ago, we called up folks and we asked, hey, how many medications are you taking on a regular basis? It's about half of America is taking at least somewhere around 4 to 5 medications on a regular basis, which is a lot of drugs. And we asked, have any of these medications increased in price suddenly when you went to go fill the prescription? 22% of people said yes, one of my drugs went up in price. That is roughly about 27 million people told us, that's our estimate. So we also learned that about a quarter of those people said that they paid $50 or more, and sometimes a lot more, sometimes into the 100, 150, 250 or higher. Which was an indicator to us that their insurance basically suddenly changed on them. So these were not necessarily, beginning of the year formulary changes, but the insurance company made a decision partway through the year that they would no longer cover that medication or not cover it very well. It's also possible, too, that a lot of people are on high deductible insurance plans. That term is just sort of like an industry term, but what it really means is you have to pay a lot of money out of pocket before your insurance actually starts working. We've spoken to families that have to spend $12,000, $15,000 before their drug benefit kicks in. So they are not filling prescriptions for EpiPens, for example, because they can't afford it. They have to pay the full price out of pocket. My back of the napkin calculations are that in the last 12 months, these 28 million people spent nearly $1.1 billion just nickel and dime out of pocket in the last 12 months paying extra for a medication because insurance changed how it was covering that drug. And that has a real-world effect. We can see that when people have to do that, about 5 to 6 million people just left the prescription at the pharmacy counter. They just walked away from it. And that is a very bad outcome. The second thing is they also move around household finances when they do fill the prescription. They don't buy as many groceries. They don't spend as much on entertainment. They use their credit cards more often to pay for everyday bills. Some people even told us they delayed retirement, if you can believe that, in order to keep the drug benefit that they had. So the household finance impact is very real, very profound, and there is no sign that this is stopping.
Before you speak, Senator Hernandez, I wanted to ask you, Lisa Gill, but aren't there alternatives that can be prescribed that might be cheaper that someone can get?
Sure, of course there are. And then so it's one of the pieces of advice that we give is, get your doctor back on the phone or ask the pharmacist, is there something else I could take instead? But remember, what happens if you've been taking insulin for, let's say, I don't know, a year, 2 years, and it's been working just great, and then all of a sudden it spikes in price because the insurance companies change which insulin it covers? Or same with a blood pressure medication. Controlling blood pressure, as you well know, is a difficult and timely process. And once you get the right combination of medications, you don't want to mess with them. So, yes, you can put the administrative burden on a consumer to start making phone calls and ask for an alternative. Our consumer hack, and it's a terrible hack, but unfortunately sometimes it's the only thing that works, is to start shopping around off of your insurance if it's a drug that you cannot substitute. And we can see from our own secret shopper surveys that shopping around can save boatloads of money, and it's a head scratcher as to why, which is probably a whole other call-in show. but it's an indicator. But really, truly, it's an indicator of how messed up things are, and how truly there's like no adult in the room when it comes to drug pricing, and that's honestly part of the problem.
So, Senator Hernandez, you're an optometrist. You represent a constituency that really pulled on your heartstrings around this issue. Tell us more.
So, I mean, the reason why I decided to introduce the bill, we did it about 3.5-4 years ago, is as being chair of the Senate Health Committee, there's three things that are a priority to me. Obviously, number one is the successful implementation of the Affordable Care Act. The second thing is access to care, especially poor communities, rural, et cetera. And the third is controlling healthcare costs. There was some comments made about the prescription drugs continuing to go up. And if you think about the cost of our health insurance, and when I speak to Peter Lee on a regular basis, who is the executive director of Cover California for our buying group here in California, the number one concern by consumers is the cost of the premium. So the insurance companies are trying to do everything they possibly can to control those costs, and they're doing that by offering plans that have higher deductibles. They're going to pass on the prescription drug costs because that's one of the costs that continues to go up. So when we looked at doing this, Bill, I say we because my staff and I, and we kind of put the language together, the road I didn't want to go down, because I still believe in the free market system that we have in this country, is not to set prices. But just do a modest bill that would do two things. Number one, it would bring transparency by requiring the purchasers and the health plans to list the 25 most expensive drugs every year, the year and year over increase, and then the cost, the percentage of money that goes towards the premium dollar. So down the road, if we see that it just significantly increases compared to everyone else, let's say it's doctors or health insurance or the hospitals, then the legislature can ask the question, why is that? And what is the value? Why do we not have value-based and challenge the pharmaceutical drug industry to have a value-based pricing system? The second part of the bill, it would require the pharmaceutical drug industry to give advance notice when there's an increase in price. It's 16% over a two-year period, to allow, like the state of California, when a new drug comes in, to be able to get prepared for it, to be able to negotiate. And if necessary, I believe what Lisa said, to switch to a different formulary to try to get a prescription that fits within that formulary at a lower cost. So for us and for me, it's very, very important. Yes, insurance is important. Yes, access is important. But if our consumers can't afford the insurance, and they can't afford their prescription drugs, then what's the sense of having a healthcare system? And that's why we introduced this bill. And it was as modest as the bill it was, there was significant amount of opposition from the industry itself.
And we'll hear more about what that was, what that's been like. But first, I want to turn back to Professor Feldman. Do you happen to know how much of premium increases are due to the increasing drug costs or other parts of the healthcare delivery system, whether it's, the cost of getting a test done or a hospitalization or a doctor's bill?
I can't tell you the percentage. I can tell you that the cost of medication within all the things that you just listed is rising at a faster pace than absolutely anything within the healthcare system, anything that's been measured in any way. This is the one that's rising the fastest. You know, Lisa Gill mentioned a little while ago that it's a head-scratcher that if consumers shop around, they will find different prices for the drugs if they are finally in the desperate position of not being able to use their health insurance to pay for the drug. The reason for that is because of some of the game-playing that happens when consumers are captive to their particular health plan and when pharmaceutical companies and the intermediaries take advantage of that captive environment to try to offer various incentives that end up pushing consumers towards more expensive drugs. It isn't a good system for anyone. It's very complicated, very difficult to break through. Consumers work around that, that's the best thing they can do for themselves.
I just want to jump in and mention that transparency. So to that issue, you know, transparency, which is the key to SB 17, what makes it such a huge step, good step forward, both for the state and potentially for the nation. But forcing transparency, forcing a drug company to explain why a medication is going to increase in price, giving due notice, is exactly what's missing. And I know we've talked about a minute ago about the free market, and this is a free market, but it is not a free market, and that's bringing transparency would allow that to happen, and that's why it's so important, and that's why my little hack about shopping around is an effort to bring transparency to the consumer. At the same time, it's quickly just calling a few pharmacies in your area, a Walmart, a Costco, a Walgreens, and figuring out that they can be a 10 times difference. I am not joking. In the price of like an everyday drug, seriously, atorvastatin, generic Lipitor, you can buy it for like $17 at Costco or $100. I'm going to look here real fast. You could buy it for literally $135 at CVS, Target, or $14. And you just make a few phone calls to figure that out. The transparency is absent, and SB 17 brings that to the state, and it's essential.
So a quick follow-up question there. My understanding is that it's not the first time you ask for the price that you might get that $17 price. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's another little fun fact. So part of what our secret shoppers just sort of accidentally discovered is that you can ask for the price, and you'll be given a price, and we would jot down the price. And then our statisticians would look at all the prices and say, you know, there's a couple of outliers. Why don't you call back and ask them for the lowest price they could give you? And it turns out in many cases, a shopper would get an even lower price. Now, sometimes that would just trigger a pharmacist's memory and say, oh, you know what, that drug is on our $4 discount generic list, and I forgot to tell you that. But in most cases, it was just they found some of the discount program. But what we later learned is something called gag clauses. We were shocked to find this out, that pharmacy benefit contracts between a pharmacy benefit manager, which is what we call sort of the intermediary, but it's basically like part of the supply chain. It's like one of the middlemen. Pharmacy benefit manager contracts with retail pharmacies sometimes have language in them that prohibit a pharmacist from offering the lower retail price, if one exists, if it's better than your insurance. And the way to like unlock it is for the consumer to say, hey, what is the lowest price you can give me? And then the pharmacist feels compelled and sort of free to be able to give you that price. It is a crazy sort of situation, but it's again indicative of like the lack of transparency and how it's incumbent upon consumers and the state and governments to really try to get at what are those actual costs.
Robin Feldman, aren't generics supposed to like make this better? Why is that not helping here?
So when generics make it to market and they survive, they can bring the cost of a drug down eventually by 80% to 85%. Those are huge decreases, but drug companies are putting up a series of stumbling blocks to try to keep the generics from coming onto market. They have been extraordinarily effective across time at being able to keep generics out and keep the prices high.
What do they do?
Also, to So the games include a variety of things, from paying the generic company to stay off of the market as part of a settlement. Some of the games also include filing frivolous claims at the FDA or also lawsuits to try to prevent the generics from coming to market. Also work in other ways within the reimbursement system to prevent a generic from ever being substituted for the brand name drug. One of the ways that generics save money is they don't advertise. They depend on the fact that when a doctor writes a particular prescription, takes it to the pharmacist can fill it with the generic version. But if brand name companies are able to manipulate the formulary or manipulate the definition of the name of a drug in a way that substitution doesn't happen, the generic never gets off the ground.
So forgive me if I'm misapplying these terms, but this sounds like collusion. Perhaps there's antitrust issues here. Has anyone talked about those as tactics to address some of these practices?
Yes. Antitrust law is one of the levers that could be used, as are various laws against regulatory manipulation and regulatory abuse. All of these are difficult to bring about. So antitrust claims have come to life in what are called the pay-for-delay cases. That's an old form of collusion in which a brand company pays the generic to stay off the market. It's accomplished under the guise of settling claims in court between the two parties. So in 2013, the Supreme Court, in a case called Actavis, opened the door to antitrust scrutiny of pay-for-delay agreements, and that, in theory, makes the pay-for-delay agreement more difficult to accomplish and uphold, but the reality is much more complicated. Now, brand companies just engage in more complex deals that are more difficult to find, or they simply end up paying the fines, fighting off the cases, and in the end, it's worth it. Let me give you an example. So Teva, the brand name company, had paid four generic competitors to stay off the market for 6 years. The Federal Trade Commission filed an antitrust suit against Teva, and class action lawsuits were filed as well, alleging antitrust violations. After the Supreme Court decision in 2013, making it easier to challenge pay-for-delay agreements under antitrust, Teva settled all its lawsuits, and here's how the numbers work. So Teva originally paid $300 million to the four generics to stay off the market. Then the company paid $500 million to settle the class action lawsuits and $1.2 billion in fines to the Federal Trade Commission. So if you add all those together, the pay-for-delay deal cost the company $2 billion. So ouch, one would think, but not so fast. The company still made a decent profit. Teva estimated that it got an additional $4 billion in sales from the pay-for-delay deal. So even after paying for the delay, paying for the fines and settlement, the company was still left with a tidy sum of $2 billion. It was quite profitable, and it cost the government an inordinate sum just to get that far in this one case.
Just the price of doing business, it sounds like. Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing curbing the costs of prescription drugs with our guests, Professor Robin Feldman, Director of the Institute for Innovation Law at the University of California, Hastings, and author of Drug Wars, How Big Pharma Raises Prices and Keeps Generics Off the Market, Lisa Gill, Deputy Editor of Consumer Reports Best Buy Drugs, and Senator Ed Hernandez, the Chair for the Senate Committee on Health and author of Senate Bill 17, which is was been signed into law, is trying to get drug companies to be more transparent about their pricing and give more advance notice on increases in prices. Again, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. The number to dial is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go to our first caller, Elkhorn from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to talk about a blood thinner called Coumadin, which costs quite a bit of money. Unfortunately, that is the 1930s rat poison that used to be known as warfarin. And it's, in addition, when you are taking Coumadin, you have to have a blood test at least once a week.
Okay. Thanks so much, Elkhorn, for your comment. Let's go next to Nancy from Berkeley. Nancy, thanks for waiting.
Give you idea of my experience with the pharmaceutical company. Anyways, I'm a member of Kaiser, and many, many years ago, I suffered horribly from migraine headaches, and my migraine drug was not on the Kaiser formulary, and so it was going to cost me about $3,000 a month. And so I got it from England, and then I got it from Canada, and it cost me about maybe $300. And I did that for a really long time, and finally Kaiser put it on their formulary, and now it costs me $35 for, I don't know, 100 pills or something. So there you are. And my question is, you know, other countries don't have this problem, and, you know, I feel helpless. I feel like there's just nothing we can do here in the awful USA. Does anybody have any ideas?
Thanks for your question there, Nancy. It's a great one. Who would like to take that question first? Why can other countries negotiate better prices than the United States?
So this is Professor Feldman. I would start by saying that the caller's experience with her drug is something that lots of consumers have experienced with lots of other drugs. The costs of drugs in this country are much higher than for the same drugs around the world. U.S. consumers are subsidizing lower drug prices everywhere, and it happens with a variety of ways in which our system is set up that allows it. Some of it are the complexities that the drug companies exploit for keeping competitors out. And some of it also has to do with the advertising that Senator Hernandez mentioned earlier. There are only two countries in the world, the United States and New Zealand, that allow drug companies to advertise directly to consumers. And we are one of them, and that cost gets rolled into the cost of the drug. That type of advertising also can encourage and push consumers towards particular drugs, even if they're not the right mix or even if they're more expensive. That's a large part of the problem. You mentioned at the beginning of the show a recent 200-page report from the National Academies of Science, and one of the key findings in that report related to the problems of advertising to consumers. It's an experiment that we have entered into in this country for decades, and probably not a good one.
So another question, just to push that a little bit, about the how Americans are subsidizing drug costs around the world. There's a lot that drug companies have done in terms of giving away medicines for low or no cost in resource-limited settings, let's say specifically in the HIV arena. And that's, you know, made it possible for millions of people to be treated where they wouldn't have been before. So what would you say to someone who says, but look, the pharmaceutical companies are doing good, they're being altruistic, and, you know, they're giving these medicines away for lower or no cost, and what's wrong with that? And therefore, they have to recoup their costs somehow.
So this is Professor Feldman, and I would answer that by saying they're doing well by doing good, very well. So if you think about the HIV drugs in particular, I mentioned a study at the top of our show that I just completed looking at all drugs, all non-biologic drugs on the market, and how often the companies extended their protection cliff to block out competition. Out of the 1,800 drugs that I studied, the drugs that extended their protection cliff more often, if you look at the top five, I think either three or four of them were HIV drugs. These companies are busy making sure that no other competitors can get into the market. Now, if the cost of doing that is to buy off public sentiment by donating drugs in various markets or by helping patients one way or another, that's good for business. It's not necessarily good for society as a whole.
I want to get back to you, Senator Hernandez,
sure,
to tell us a little bit more about the kind of pushback that Senate Bill 17 has faced since it's been signed into law. I imagine
sure,
even prior to it being signed into law.
Yeah, by all means. But I'd like to also follow up on the comment that was made earlier, you know, with regard to, for example, like the AIDS drug. You know, it's still a very, very small percentage of the overall market that they have. And another thing that the pharmaceutical drug industry does, let's say there is a prescription drug that's pushed by a particular physician, whether it's a generic and or let's say it's a name brand, but especially if it's a name brand, the patients will complain, and the pharmaceutical drug industry has these programs that will say, well, if you call us, we will give you a coupon or a discount so that if it's their drug, they'll waive the copay. Well, I mean, that sounds great. Here they are, they're helping consumer, but what's happening is the insurance company is still picking up the tab for the majority of the benefit, and that's passed on to the consumer. So the consumer's happy. They're saying, you know what, I don't have to pay for it, that's great, but it's still passed on, whereas you can probably get a very similar outcome with another drug that is significantly less. And there was a comment made by somebody, I forgot who it was, that, you know, it's the way they do business, and they're doing really well. Well, yes, they are doing really well, and that's the reason why I believe there was so much opposition. Keep in mind, I thought this was a very modest bill. It was transparency and it's giving advance notice. But this bill, after it was signed into law, is probably the most advanced transparency bill that we have in this country. They hired literally 60 to 64 lobbyists every year that we introduced this just to kill this bill because there is so much at stake. A pure transparency bill is going to... They're just literally afraid of the fact of what we're going to find out. What is the real cost? There was comments made about that it's between 10 and 20%. Whenever I speak to the pharmaceutical drug industry, they say, oh, we're only 10% of the entire market. Well, that's not necessarily true. When we looked at our numbers, it was hitting close to 20% and continuing to go up. So there was a lot of opposition to this legislation.
And on what grounds are they calling this bill, this law, unconstitutional?
For a couple of ways, they're just saying that there's going to be stockpiling, there's interstate commerce clauses that are in effect. They're talking about the fact that they have to spend a lot of money in research and development. So there's numerous allegations, and those are the opposition that was given at the various hearings. But we crafted this bill very, very carefully to not tell them that they can't raise prices. It's a pure transparency bill that the reporting is going to be done by the health insurance industry, not the drug industry. And there's advance notification if the drug goes up a certain percentage. They just have to notify and justify why that is. So it was very, very carefully drafted so that we would not violate any kind of interstate commerce laws, but more importantly, to allow them, they can raise them as much as they want. They just have to tell the purchasers at the time when they do it.
And we have an email from Karen that asks more about specifically what will SB 17 accomplish. So what I would say is, what do you think this transparency will lead to? And then the second question, either for you or the other guests, are what are other states doing to address this issue? Are any contracting, for example, with pharmacies in other countries like Canada?
So my opinion, what this bill is going to do, and it's going to look in the out years, is we're going to really know what the true cost of prescription drugs are, the total percentage that goes towards the premium dollar that we as consumers, and it's going towards the premium dollar of the health policy. And if we see that that's consistent, it doesn't go up a lot, then, you know, that can be part of how the market trends. But if there's a significant increase compared to the rest of the market, whether it be hospitals, whether it be providers, whether it be, you know, health plans, then we need to ask this tough question. And I really believe that if we are going to make a change in this country, it really should be at the federal level. And we need to have a conversation about patenting laws. We have to have a conversation about the amount of money that goes into research and development into these prescription drugs. But if you look at what's happened, after the first year when I introduced my bill, several other states, I believe close to 20, 21 states, introduced similar transparency bills because the cost to their local state governments, whether they're Medicaid or Medi-Cal systems, and the overall cost of the premium. So you're starting to see this coalition and of the states that are asking these tough questions because they have to pay for those through their local state governments.
So here's another example, as we've talked about many times on the show, of how states are leading the fight where the federal government may not be participating, to say the least. Robin Feldman, tell us a little bit more about what the report that you quoted earlier from the National Institute of Sciences, I'm sorry if I'm getting that wrong, stated were some things that the federal government could do, and how likely, given our current political climate, would those things actually ever come to pass?
So first, I would like to say that the area of regulation of health insurance, pharmaceutical interactions, consumer interactions, buying prescriptions, these are classic areas in which both the states play a role and the federal government plays a role. One of the issues I see stressed over and over again is that there are important roles for both the state and the federal government to play in trying to tame this tiger. One of your callers, or perhaps an emailer, asked about what other states are doing. I believe the last time I checked, there were at least 30 states that either had passed or introduced some version of a transparency bill trying to get at the hidden games in pharmaceutical pricing. The pharmaceutical industry has put a full court press on to oppose those, as Senator Hernandez said, through lobbying in the State House, and then to fight them in court battles once those are passed. The industry has suggested that transparency legislation, other types of legislation, are unconstitutional because they somehow anything that has to do with health care or anything that relates to any type of product that has a patent on it anywhere can only be handled at the federal level, or that somehow asking the industry to give information violates First Amendment rights because it's speech. Neither of those should be a successful argument. The states absolutely have rights to regulate those consumer transactions that happen inside their borders, particularly when they're talking about providing truthful information. We require truthful information from all kinds of industries, from banking to movers to insurance companies, all kinds of things. We tell companies what they have to provide, and this is no different. There are difficult decisions on the books, not at the Supreme Court level, but lower than that, that are problematic and that would need to be moved out of the way. So if your listeners are listening to this, the message I would love to give them is that key players in this really are sitting in Congress. And it's an opportunity to write to your representatives and let them know how much you care about this issue, how much you'd like to see transparency, and how much you'd like to see changes in the law that make it clear that these types of rules are going to happen at the federal level and are perfectly acceptable at the state level as well.
And one idea that came out of that report is granting Medicare to negotiate prices, which it currently does not have, correct?
That is correct. And right now the federal government doesn't have the ability to do that through Medicare. And when our president was running for office, said that he was going to do something about that when he got elected. And, of course, when he did, nothing's happened. That's why I really believe that besides the states acting like the way they have, and all these close to 30 states are introducing similar types of bills, I think we need to do something at the federal level, and whether it's dealing with patenting issues and or dealing with transparency at the federal level, and have the ability for Medicare to be able to negotiate prices, because it's such a large negotiating body, they can do that.
Mm. And Lisa Gill, what other things besides what you've already mentioned can consumers do to get better prices for the drugs? You talked about literally shopping around and asking more than once. Is this the best price you can give me? Other things?
Right. Always make sure that you actually need to be taking that medication. We have seen Consumer Reports has conducted other nationally representative surveys that found a majority of patients, when they ask their physician, hey, can I stop taking any of my medications? In most cases, a physician will deprescribe or take you off of one of your meds. And so that's a good thing that helps save money and also reduces your risk of side effects. Shopping around is a good one. Always asking, is there an alternative if that medication becomes too expensive? Is there a lower price? And also, I will say we're big fans of two services called GoodRx and BlinkHealth.com. These are for when your insurance is just not cutting it for you. Your insurance is not covering your medication well or not covering it at all. Both GoodRx and BlinkHealth are websites. One of them is a voucher site. You pay in advance. The other is a coupon. GoodRx is a coupon site. This is for when you're going to pay cash. And paying cash is not a great idea. It means that your transaction may not be captured by your insurance company. It also means that none of that money goes toward a deductible or toward if you're in the donut hole. But if there's no other way to get your medication, that paying cash may be the only way. Those are good sites to do some comparative shopping in your area and possibly get a lower price. Actually, you have a very good chance of getting a lower price. And I want to mention one other thing. In thinking about transparency, a story that we wrote last year about this issue really started to look at drug rebate money. And when you think about how much what is at stake, I want to put a finer point on it for your listeners. We're talking about anywhere from $100 billion to $120 billion of what I would call dark money. It's impossible to figure it out, but it's essentially money that is passed between these entities and middlemen as a medication goes through the supply chain. And it is very difficult to find where it lands. It winds up sometimes, it's legal. States get paid rebate money, health insurance plans get paid rebate money, employers get paid rebate money. It supposedly is meant to bring down premium prices for individuals. But I'll tell you, it's hard to tell that. And part of what the legislation, I think, that hopefully we will bring to bear is where does all this money go? Where is it? And that's, it's not just like tell us what the price is, but show us who are you paying out? When we look at the financial annual reports of companies, we can see that it looks like rebate money is tied up in the promotional spend, which can look like drug advertising, but it's also paying out to middlemen. And it's an extraordinary amount of money. It's hard to track it, and that is the kind of, in my mind, the pool that we're trying to get a closer look at.
Just like many situations like this, it's about following the money, but sounds right. Like that's really, really, really hard to do. Well, I want to thank my guests this evening for in this enlightening conversation about this very important topic that's near and dear to many of our listeners, I imagine, given the percentages of people who are on multiple pharmaceutical drugs that we described earlier. Those guests were Robin Feldman, director of the Institute for Innovation Law at the University of California, Hastings, and author of Drug Wars, How Big Pharma Raises Prices and Keeps Generics Off the Market, Lisa Gill, deputy editor of Consumer Reports Best Buy Drugs, and Senator Ed Hernandez, the chair for the Senate Committee on Health here in California and author of Senate Bill 17. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. We'll be away for the holidays for the next couple of Mondays. Join us again live here on Monday, January 8th. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. From all of us at City Visions, best wishes for a happy and safe holiday season. See you in the new year.